Welcome to the Parenting with Presence Summit. This is a production of the Shift Network, and I'm Susan Stiffelman. I'm your host and the author of Parenting Without Power Struggles, Raising Joyful, Resilient Kids While Staying Cool, Calm, and Connected. And we're so glad that you're joining us. This summit has been quite an experience, I can say for myself, just as someone who's been allowed to hear each call and participate in these conversations, that I'm taking notes, I'm learning so much, I'm absorbing so many insights and so much wisdom from the people that who have participated. And we'd love to hear from you. We'd love to hear what you have to say, what you want to ask, or any contributions or insights that you're having. The way to do that is to visit parentingwithpresence.com/comments. And I want to remind everyone, because particularly because the population for this call may be busy parents or grandparents or aunts and uncles or teachers, that the calls are available for 48 hours for free as a download. You can listen to what we're sharing right now or share it with your friends for 2 days, and I think there'll be another little window there, so watch for your emails that announce that, because we do want to make sure that we make it convenient for you to hear, even if you're not able to on the spot. So our guest today is a wonderful, insightful, brilliant man, teacher, writer, speaker, and his name is Daniel Siegel, and he will be hopping on the call in a moment. There was a traffic snafu, so he'll be joining us any second now. Daniel Siegel is the clinical professor of psychiatry at the UCLA School of Medicine, and he's on the faculty of the Center for Culture, Brain, and Development. He is also the co-director of the Mindful Awareness Research Center. He's the executive director of MindSight Institute, which is an educational organization that focuses on the development of MindSight in individuals and families and communities, and he'll say more about that in our talk today. Dr. Siegel has published extensively, and his book, MindSight, The New Science of Personal Transformation, offers an in-depth exploration of the power of the mind to integrate that brain and to promote well-being. And I also want to point out that, especially for this audience, Dr. Siegel is the author of Parenting from the Inside Out, which many parents consider one of their core reference books for understanding and deepening the relationship they have with their children and with the parenting experience. So his website is drdansiegel.com. That's drdansiegel.com. And in a moment, he'll be joining us. Meanwhile, let me just offer my own experience of Dr. Siegel's work. You know, there are so many parenting books available to us when we have our child. Some of us go out and buy everything possible. Our shelves are filled with different expert opinions and advice because we want to do the best that we can. The baby is handed to us, or the child, you know, if you've adopted a child, you find yourself suddenly in this role of parent. And even though our children might think that we're perfect, I know that my son and I have gone through many, you know, amazing conversations and growth-producing conversations where I have explained to him that I would have liked to be a perfect parent, but it's probably not likely because, like him, I had parents who are human beings who struggle and learn and had their own challenges. In fact, recently I said to him something like, you know, I do my best, I try my best, and I want to keep learning and growing, and I this experience of being your parent is such a blessing, and you've never visited the planet where I come from. And he really appreciated that, because while his childhood has had its own challenges, they aren't the same as mine. And so what Dr. Siegel brings to this conversation, that's one of the many things, has to do with us looking at how our own experiences growing up shaped who we are now as a parent, and how we have the opportunity when we're raising our children to heal those things, and continue to grow into a more available presence for our child. Is Dr. Siegel on yet?
Yes, I am. Hi there.
Oh, good. I'm so glad you're here. Thank you, Daniel, for joining us.
My pleasure, Susan.
So, what does it mean to parent with the brain in mind?
Well, it means a lot of things. To start with, thanks for having me on your summit, and thanks for putting this together with Shift. I think it's a great idea to raise the awareness of everyone, but especially parents who are really facing the incredible challenge of raising kids these days. And parenting with the brain in mind is simply a phrase we can use to say that there's a lot from science, not just from brain science, but that's one of the sciences, that can inform how we approach a wise way of being parents in this world. And so parenting with the brain in mind just means keeping in the front of your awareness some of these scientific findings that can be extremely helpful in really creating an approach and a strategy for self-understanding is the first thing, but then also for understanding your child and then what to do with your child. So that's the general phrase, is parenting with the brain in mind. The specific thing about it is, you know, we can say the following thing from science. We can say, as parents, what we do and how we are shapes the way the connections of cells in our children, especially in their nervous system, including their brain and their head, how those connections will be made. So what you do and how you are as a parent, we now know, shapes the not only function, but the structure of your child's nervous system, of their, we'll just call it the brain, but it's an embodied brain throughout the whole body, really. So that's really exciting. So then the question is, well, what can we do as parents in a scientifically informed way that builds on the wisdom of ancient traditions to help us build the kinds of interpersonal connections that shape the brain connections in our child so they can become resilient, they can become wise, they can become kind, compassionate, creative. All these things we actually now have insights into, and that's what parenting with the brain in mind specifically means.
Oh, please go on.
Well,
great.
I mean, you know, here's just to give you a little background, and you may have said a little bit about this in the introduction. But you know, I'm trained as a not only a biologist but as a physician, and I work in the field of child and adolescent psychiatry, having started originally in pediatrics. So I come from a scientific background as a clinician, but then I'm also trained as a researcher. So I am trained as someone to do research in attachment, which is how children and parents relate with each other and how that shapes development. And so for me, I was very interested in knowing how relationships shape children's minds. And then this was all emerging back in the late 80s, and it was just when a lot of the science of the brain was really coming into the fore because the technology had advanced enough. So in the early 90s, I was very interested in asking questions like, you know, how does a parent shape the brain of a child? Or, you know, what is the connection between the mind and the brain? And are they the same or are they different? And you know, how do relationships fit into all that? And how does culture shape that? How does consciousness influence the way parents can shape the mind of the child? And what does that have to do with the brain of the child, too, or the brain of the parent? So these are things that really I became basically obsessed with. And so I felt that the best way for me to understand that, because I felt like I really didn't know much as a clinician trained in modern approaches and being board certified and everything you could be certified in. And I thought, you know, I just didn't really know anything. I felt kind of like a fraud. So I started really turning toward all the different sciences that existed beyond medicine. And so I worked with people in anthropology and sociology and psychology and different branches of biology, including neuroscience and chemistry and physics and mathematics, and put together this field called interpersonal neurobiology, which is basically a phrase to mean everything from the inner personal life we have, like what we do in meditation or contemplative practices, to interpersonal things like what we do in our relationships, and extending those personal and interpersonal stuff of our lives that we experience in our home life, in our society life, how do we actually relate that to, say, synapses in the brain, the connections among neurons, and what do we know about the physics of how energy and information stream through the nervous system, and what does that have to do with our personal and interpersonal experience? So interpersonal neurobiology just says, what if we combined all the sciences into one perspective? And a book I wrote called The Developing Mind, published in the last millennium in 1999, it really tried to wrestle with some of these questions and put it out there that the relationships, the brains, and the minds we all have are three aspects of one reality. Relationships, brain, and mind are not separable things, but they're three aspects of one reality. Just like if you had a coin in your hand, the coin would have an edge, it would have a heads, it would have a tail. You would be able to say that this one coin has three aspects. The same way human life has these three aspects. And so the science of all this was to draw on everything from anthropology to physics and say, can you say what the mind is, which no disciplines had a definition of the mind, amazingly. Mm-hmm. Even the philosophy of mind doesn't have a definition of mind, fascinatingly. Psychiatry and psychology don't have a definition of mind. So we offered a definition of mind and then said, well, now that we have a definition of mind, can you say what a healthy mind is, which is what we do, and then can you actually develop applications of this scientific perspective so that you could build a whole approach to whatever, to living your personal life and understand, let's say, mindfulness, or living your relational life and understand your close connections with other people, including your kids. Interpersonal neurobiology is a synthesis of all the sciences, and then we try to apply it. So this is all background to say that what I'm about to tell you about the practical implications of parenting with the brain in mind, or, you know, I wrote a book with Mary Hartzell called Parenting from the Inside Out, which basically explores how to apply interpersonal neurobiology to the amazing finding that the best predictor of the attachment your child will have to you, which isn't everything, but it's a lot of really important things like how they develop emotional and social skills, how they develop resilience, how they feel about themselves, how they understand themselves and others, things like that. That's attachment shapes those things. The best predictor of your child's attachment to you is actually your own self-understanding. And so we wrote a whole book, you know, helping parents develop self-understanding with a lot of supportive ways of, you know, Mary and I basically think of that book as one big hug, you know, as you go through the process of trying to make sense of yourself. But we also put in a little bit of science so people could understand that there's a huge amount behind it. Mm-hmm. In the meantime, after Parenting from the Inside Out came out, I was asked to edit a series of books. So I've edited, as a founding editor of the Norton series, 36 textbooks in this field. And so I've been busy just working professionally, trying to make professionals have access to this information. And then since then, one of my students, who now is my colleague, Tina Bryson, and I wrote a book called The Whole Brain Child. And that one really says, okay, well, once you work on self-understanding, you know, what do you actually do in your strategy to parenting? And that book is all about the interpersonal neurobiology finding that what we say is, you know, the health comes from a process called integration, which is the linkage of differentiated parts. And that linkage can happen in a relationship, which is defined as the sharing of energy and information between you and other people. So integration in a relationship would be, Susan, where I would honor the difference between you and me, but then you and I would have compassionate, kind communication with each other. And that would be the linkage. So we then would have an integrated relationship. And what we say in interpersonal neurobiology, it sounds painfully simple, but when I revised The Developing Mind in its second edition with 15 interns, I told them, you know, prove that all these ideas are wrong, and let's just write a whole new book. Let's junk the other one. But the fact is they found a lot of supportive evidence over the last 12 years to support the ideas, including this idea I'm about to tell you, integrated relationships, that is, honoring differences, promoting linkages in a compassionate way, integrated relationships stimulate the growth of integrative fibers in the brain. Integrated relationships stimulate the growth of integrative fibers in the brain. And these are long neurons that link widely separated areas to each other. It creates a structural linkage, but it allows a functional coordination and balance of the whole body and even the person in a social world. So the importance of integrative circuits is that all regulation in the brain comes from integration. And the reason for that is that to regulate, you've got to be able to monitor something and modify it and coordinate and balance different aspects of the system. And so the way you do that is you have these fibers that literally, you know, allow you to monitor what's happening in very distant areas or different regions. Mm-hmm. And then basically coordinate them. So it's not rocket science. It may be brain science, but it's not rocket science
Say
that, okay, you know, when you have integration in the brain, you get regulation. And that's basically regulation is what every parent wants for their child.
Yes, yes, yes.
You know, in professional terms, we call it, you know, executive functions. We call it self-regulation. And specifically, we say, you know, we want a child to learn to regulate feelings, you know, emotions, and to attention and behavior and thinking and stuff like that. So that's the bottom line.
There's more I know, and I don't want to. If you're not done, then I don't want to interrupt you, but have a great question as soon as you feel complete on the explanation there.
No, it's great. Please.
Well, first of all, it's so stimulating for me to listen to you, and it's a stretch because you are so comfortable in a world that I'm peeking in the window looking. I'm fascinated by the brain, but it's a huge area, and it's certainly not my area of expertise, but that's why I love listening to you.
Thanks. We all have our things we do, you know.
Yes. So, but this issue of regulation, because I'm sort of down in the trenches with parents, whether I have the children or the parents or the family in the office or I'm on the phone coaching, and I could probably reduce to that one word, regulation, the majority of the calls or visits, you know, that a child is impulsive, they are snappy, they're moody, and I would love to hear you talk about the application of this idea. How do we as parents respond or engage with our children or with ourselves in ways that promote, of course, our own, but then the child regulation when we live in a culture where sometimes for good reasons, but often excessively, children are being medicated in an attempt to achieve the behavior of regulation, but we aren't necessarily helping them regulate. Can you speak to that?
Yeah, beautifully said, Susan. Thank you. I agree. I mean, as a child and adolescent psychiatrist, I think the word regulation is what we so often feel and see as the challenging part of people's lives, certainly families with kids, but also just anybody. So regulation, while it sounds kind of controlling, I want to regulate or something, it's actually just kind of how you create harmony in your life.
Yes,
you know,
that's
kind of what it is. So the word regulation freaks people out sometimes, but it's really the scientific term and clinical term we use for how do you create coordination and balance? How do you integrate is really what that is. So that when you integrate, you create harmony, and people struggle with that in lots of ways. You know, from this view, and I haven't said what our definition of the mind is, but when you see what it is, you'll see what parents can do very directly to create regulation in their child's lives in the moment, and then to allow their child to develop these integrative circuits, give them the power of integration in their lives. So one way of just starting with it is we say, and you know, you and I are talking about parenting and presence and, you know, what parents can do. because in these different books I've written, it depends on who the audience is, how much detail they would get, and just like in this conversation, how much detail I'm about to give would depend on who's listening. So for people who want a lot of detail, I'm going to give the very formal definition. If you don't want that much detail, then I'm going to follow that formal definition with a much shorter one, and then right after that, I'm going to say exactly what's useful about this definition. So hold on, but since I don't know who you are listening, and Susan, since you said you are interested in the brain, I'll just give you, I'll do it in that order. Is that okay?
Thank you. That sounds great. And I can even feel in the way you're communicating with me and with the rest of us, this way that you're creating this attunement and you're comforting us by letting us know what's coming.
That's good. Well, I'm so glad because, I just finished writing this book for teenagers or older adolescents and their parents to both read. It's called Brainstorm. And it was really challenging, I got to say, to write it because I kept on thinking of the teenager, and on the first version of the book, I was like way too identified with teenagers. So then I wrote it more like from the parents' perspective, and I was always test driving it on different teenagers and adults who would read it. So I said, oh, no, this is, So I had to really, because there is no book like that out there for both parent and teenager to read. So I said, this would be really important and challenging to try to write, but let me see if I can do it. So I really had to get the feedback and feel the experience of the different readers. And I think I'm especially aware because the first version of the book was so crazy long that a lot of people said, wow, this is so interesting, but it's way too long. So I had to cut the book in half, But I realized that, sometimes less is more, And you just want to really be very specific. So it's like Mark Twain, I think, once said, he said, I didn't have time to write a short letter. So sometimes you really have to take more time. Yeah. So the new and final version of Brainstorm is much shorter and to the point. And I hope, and we'll see how it comes across to both parents and their adolescent offspring.
Right.
But so in this definition, even in that book, the Brainstorm book, the idea is, we in interpersonal neurobiology use this thing called the mindsight approach. And mindsight is just a term I made up a long, long time ago because my professors of medicine lacked it. And after I dropped out of medical school and decided to go back, I said to myself, if I'm going to go back there, very likely these professors have not changed. They would act like patients were like bags of chemicals without feelings and without stories and without a center of your own conscious experience. It was so sad and so painful. And as a young student, I just didn't want to become like that. I was really young and impressionable, and I really wanted to please my teachers, blah, blah. But I did not want to become like that, so I dropped out. So when I came back, I said, okay, what those teachers seem to be missing is seeing the mind, the inner subjective experience of their patients and even of us, their students. So I said, okay, they don't have mindsight. And some people do, and I should gravitate toward the people with mindsight watch out when I'm with someone who's mindsightless, that they're going to maybe be caring and smart, but they won't be tuned in to my internal world or the internal world of patients. So just like sometimes it's good to see a bad play, so you really appreciate a good one, I told myself, maybe as a rationalization, okay, these bad role models will be useful in an anti-role model kind of way. This is what you should not be like, And so mindsight in writing a book is really useful, but in terms of this definition of mind, what we say is that, the mind has subjective experience and it has consciousness, which we can talk about a lot more in a moment. But in addition to those two really important inner, non-measurable, but real aspects of our core personal, subjectively lived, conscious lives, there's a third aspect of mind that comes from a long line of reasoning I talk about in depth in The Developing Mind and The Pocket Guide to Interpersonal Neurobiology, which is basically this, that the system that the mind is emerging from is not just in your brain, in your head. It's certainly distributed throughout your whole body. And it's actually, if you really think about it deeply, about how your feelings and thoughts and hopes and dreams, how they're affected by your relationships with other people. Like, Susan, do you feel like your relationships with someone close to you is affecting your feelings?
Of course.
Yeah. So then you say, well, okay, then your mental life, your feelings, your thoughts, is shaped by relationships. What's with that? So what we say is that, well, this process of mind is not just embodied. It's also relational. So then you say, okay, well, what would be the essence of this system that connects the body and relationships? And I'll shorten the long discussion here, but, you know, the online program we have, where we have, like, students studying with me for 3 years, you know, I'll say to them, like, for a homework assignment on one of the weeks, I'll say, here's your homework assignment. You know, what is a thought?
God.
And that's it. And then the next week, we go over the homework. And, of course, there's no right answer because nobody knows what a thought is. No one even knows what a feeling is. Of course, we have thoughts, we have feelings, yes, yes. But the fact is, from a scientific point of view, we don't have a way of describing them. So in this definition of mind, beyond subjective experience of what a feeling is or a thought is, or the conscious awareness of a feeling or thought, we say, okay, well, the mind is a system that is, or part of a system, an aspect of a system, that's both embodied and relational. So it has to do with something that's shared in relationships and the body. What is that? Then we say, okay, well, energy and information, energy is the potential to do something, and information is a swirl of energy that has symbolic value. Energy, and its subset, some forms of energy and information, they move across time, and that word is flow. So energy and information flow is the fundamental thing that happens in your body, especially your nervous system, including what's up in your head. But it also happens, like what's happening between me and you, Susan, and what's happening between you and me and anyone who's listening to this discussion. Energy and information is streaming between the two of us and among all of us. Then you go, okay, cool. Well, then energy and information is your basic unit. Then you say, okay, so the system we're talking about is not defined by the skin. It's a system that's open to lots of influences. It's capable of being chaotic. These are important elements. And it's also called nonlinear, meaning small inputs lead to large results that you can't predict. So we call that nonlinear, chaos-capable, open system actually has a formal name in science. It's called a complex system. And complexity theory is the branch of mathematics that's a part of probability theory, which is a branch of mathematics. These theories, basically, the probability division, looking at complexity theory, says that from a complex system emerges a self-organizing process that both arises from and turns back and regulates that from which it arose, which is called recursivity. It arises from it, and it turns back and regulates it. Now, when I heard that back in the early 90s, when I read about it in my readings, I went nuts because I said, okay, so the mind is the self-organizing, emergent process that is both relational and embodied, that is regulating energy and information flow. Period. That's the long version.
Oh.
The short version is, you know, beyond consciousness, beyond subjective experience, this third aspect of mind is defined this way: an embodied and relational process that regulates the flow of energy and information. Now, that flow, where is it? Within you and between you. Within you and between you. So then you go, okay, cool. Then how do you build strong regulation, and how do you make regulation be healthy? And then once we've defined the mind this way, the natural next thing to do is say, can you define a healthy mind? And again, in the Pocket Guide to Developing Mind, you'll see the long, long, long scientific discussions about this. So I'm just going to give you the punchline to the joke, which is, yes, you can define a healthy mind. A healthy mind is when energy and information flow is integrated. And you go, oh my gosh. So the body is the embodied mechanism of energy and information flow. Relationships are the sharing of that flow, and the mind is the regulation of that flow, three aspects of one reality. We have that covered. Then you say a healthy mind is that regulation which drives energy and information flow within you and between you toward integration. And then you say, oh my gosh, when something is integrated, what happens? It's in harmony. And when something's not integrated, amazingly, the science shows it goes to chaos or rigidity. So then you say, okay, the first take-home message for parents is when your family life is becoming super chaotic, things are nutty, crazy, out of control, wild, just you're losing your mind because things are just so unpredictable and, well, chaotic, that's a system that you're living in that's not integrated.
Yes.
A system can also move to rigidity, where things are shut down, they lose their vitality, they're unchanging, they're completely predictable and boring. And when it's lost that vitality, you've also left the river of integration. So if you think about a river with two banks, the river of integration is harmony. One bank outside of that river is chaos. The other bank outside of that river is rigidity. And suddenly, you've explained basically all of family life. And for those of you who like mental health issues, you've explained the entire book of the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, because all of it is chaos and rigidity. And then what we could do is predict that major psychiatric disorders would show structural impairments to integrative fibers, which turns out to be true. Whether they're genetically caused or even experientially caused, as in abuse and neglect, or things that have nothing to do with abuse and neglect, like autism or schizophrenia or bipolar disorder, those all are examples of impaired integration. That's a whole other talk. But in terms of parenting, here's what we say. You now have, step one, a way of measuring whether your family is functioning in an integrated way. So check for chaos and rigidity. You want to aim for harmony. How do you do that? Step number two, you build the capacity for regulation.
Yeah.
What this means, regulate, whenever you're regulating anything, you're monitoring something. That is, you have to observe what's happening with it, and then you're modifying that thing. So you're not only sensing it, you have to shape it. And you shape it toward integration. But the first step has got to be you're tracking how something is going. So track and transform, or sense and shape, or modify after you've monitored. These are the fundamental things you do as a parent. For yourself first, just like on an airplane, they say, put your oxygen mask on first and then give it to your child. You've got to teach yourself to regulate. Now, how do you do that? Let's take the example of meditation.
Okay, great.
On my website, we have two basic meditations, the universal breath awareness practice, which you can download for free, and the wheel of awareness practice, which we teach the kids as young as 5 years of age, and parents do it as well.
And will you please repeat your website? I said
it's just drdansiegel.com. So DRDANS as in Siegel, IEGEL, drdansiegel.com. And then go to basic MindSight tools or resources, I don't remember which the tab is, and you'll find these two practices. Now, the first practice, the breath awareness, is especially useful for strengthening the capacity to monitor energy and information flow within you. And literally in the brain, what you're doing there is you're developing these what are called interoceptive circuits. It's a long discussion, but the take-home message of it is when you use your mind in meditation, which simply means training the mind, by the way, when you do a mind training regular practice, you stream energy and information flow through focused attention, through certain circuits of your brain in a certain way, and we now have very clear published research from very reputable people in extremely prominent journals that show that training your mind, let's say in mindfulness meditation as an example, strengthens the regulatory circuits, the integrative circuits of the brain. That's not an opinion. That's a fact. Now, what does that mean? Well, the first step is regulating. You're building the strength of your mind because you've trained your brain through the focus of attention, which is what your mind is doing, to just like a muscle, you strengthen the focus of attention, you get distracted. You return the focus to the breath, you get distracted. You return to the breath, you get distracted. That builds there's no muscle in the brain, but it builds the circuits of the brain because you're constantly exercising. That's the monitoring part. Then what's the modifying part?
Can we pause there for a moment?
Yeah.
Because I think it would be really fun to do that if you're willing for even 30 seconds.
Sure.
One of the things that I hear from parents a lot is, I'm so busy, I'm so busy, I'm so busy, and there's a frantic quality to how they move through the day. And the goal in this series or these calls isn't to create, you know, guilt or remorse for how you live your life. It's really to provide practical support. So what I think that you'll agree with, but certainly you can correct me if I'm off track here, but I think that you may agree that it doesn't take a half an hour or an hour of sitting in a quiet room.
Oh, no, right,
with your
exactly.
3-year-old pounding on the door. I really want parents to perhaps have an experience of even half a minute of how that can start to make a difference if you're willing, if you're game.
Sure. Well, before I do it, and I'm happy to do it right now, but let me just say, because you reminded me of the very important point, which is no matter what you went through in your own childhood, no matter what your experiences of developing a strong mind based on your attachment experiences, it is never too late to make sense of your life.
Great.
Self-understanding is something that is the key feature, and the important thing there is even if you've had horrible things happen to you, research is very clear. When you make sense of even things that made no sense when they happened, you can liberate yourself from the prison of the past and become present. You can become present for your child in a way that promotes integration. That's very clear. So the work we all have to do is support each other in the making sense process.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for that, because so many of us, you know, I often say in the strategies that I teach, people might smile, resonate, they really like it, they like the book, they like my methods, but I'll come right out and say much of it is counterintuitive at first, and that's fine. Many of us were not parented with parents who, in my verbiage, came alongside rather than at us when we were struggling or they were frustrated or we were.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't have to have a history of this fabulous, you know, perfect, whatever that might mean, childhood to bring to our own parenting lives a whole healthy way of relating and healing. And so I appreciate that you're pointing that out, because I think it's so heartening to know that it's never too late. Thank you for...
Absolutely. It's never too late. And, you know, in the book I wrote called Mindsight, I have got a 92-year-old who I call Stuart. And, you know, he started his work at 92. And you can see in that book that, you know, at that age, he was able to make profound changes, even to the point where his wife called me and asked if I had given Stuart a brain transplant, you know, because these integrative fibers can grow at any time in our life, you know. And so we really want to support each other in doing just what you're saying, Susan. Absolutely.
Great. And I know you were about to talk about modifying, so if you want to finish that piece first, please go ahead, whatever the flow is.
No, well, you know, why don't we do the breath practice so people can get a sense of the monitoring. And, you know, this is a universal practice. You may have even done it already in the series. You know, it's just always available to you to focus on the breath. And the secret of this process, I think, is to be kind to yourself. And if there isn't kindness, to even be kind to your not being kind to yourself, you know, where you create this presence to just, which is defined as just being aware of what's happening as it's happening. And if there's an observing part of yourself that takes note that you're being harsh on yourself, you can just observe that and go harshness, whatever. So the idea is to have at least one aspect of your awareness that understands that you're human, that you may be frustrated with yourself, you may be thinking you're not a good reflector, you may think you're not a good parent. Whatever you think is just a thought. It's not a fact. And in this process, what we're aiming for is building the capacity to monitor energy flow. So a very useful way to begin is just to put 2 feet flat on the floor, sit in a chair if you feel comfortable with that, or sit on the floor. And then with your eyes open, let your eyes go to the middle of the room where you might be sitting. And, of course, do not do this if you're driving a car. Wait till you can stop and listen to this in a safe place, please. So sitting down in a safe place, you let your focus of visual attention go to the middle of the room. Then let it go to the far wall. And now let your attention come back to the middle of the room. And now let your attention come to about book reading distances, if you had a book or magazine in your hand. And notice how you can determine where attention goes. And for this practice, what we're going to do is just let your attention find the sensation of the breath. And what I mean by that is you're not going to observe yourself breathing. That would be observing the breath. I mean, you're going to let the feeling, the sensation of the breath fill awareness. And to do that, let's begin by just focusing attention on the sensation of the breath at the level of the nostrils. Just let that sensation of the breath fill awareness. Comes in, goes out. Now notice how you can bring your attention down to the level of the chest. And let the sensation of the chest rising and falling fill awareness. Now, notice how you can let attention move to your belly, to your abdomen. If you're not familiar with belly breathing, put a hand on your abdomen and notice when the lungs fill with air that the abdomen moves outward. And when the lungs let the air escape, the abdomen moves inward. And just let the outward and inward movement of the abdomen fill awareness. Let that sensation of the movement of the abdomen fill awareness. Now, I'm going to share with you an ancient story that's been passed down through the generations in many cultures, and it's simply that the mind is like the ocean. And in the ocean, deep beneath the surface, it's calm and clear. And from that deep place beneath the surface of the ocean, it's possible to just look upward and notice whatever surface activities are there. Could be flat or choppy waves or even a full storm. And no matter what those conditions are, you're deep beneath the surface, it's possible to sense that tranquility and clarity and just notice whatever surface activities are going on. And the same thing is true of the mind, that just sensing the breath brings you beneath the surface activities of the mind, those brain waves that are like the thoughts and memories and worries that sometimes just come and go like waves on the surface of a mental sea. And just focusing on the breath brings you to this deep place beneath the surface. From this deep place, sense whatever those worries are, whatever those feelings or thoughts are, and just let them come and go like waves on the surface of your sea. Just sensing the breath, brings you to this deep place beneath the surface of the mind. And just spending some time each day, a minute or two, 3 minutes, 5 minutes, whatever you have time to do, can set up this deep place of tranquility inside you. So let's just do that right now, just for a minute. Let's ride the wave of the sensation of the breath in and out wherever you feel it most naturally, the level of your nostrils or the rising and falling of your chest or the abdomen moving outward and inward as you breathe in and out, or your whole body just breathing. Let's just take a minute and just ride the wave of the breath. And if you get distracted by one of those surface brain waves of a thought about dinner, worrying about what you're doing next week or what you did last month, just let that be a surface activity and let it go and return your focus to the breath. And if you need to, you can just say worrying, 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 or thinking, thinking, thinking. And for some people, just naming the kind of mental activity lets it go and you return the focus to the breath. So for this breath practice, let's do that now. Just sense the breath. A distraction comes when you note the distraction. Just let it go, naming it or not, and just let the sensation of the breath fill awareness. Now when you're ready, I invite you to a more intentional and perhaps deeper breath. If your eyes are closed, you can let your eyes gently come open, and we'll bring this breath awareness practice to a close for today. Thank you for participating in that. Susan, how was that for you?
So sweet. I found that I could just drop into a place that was so peaceful and quiet, and realizing how accessible that really is when we're talking about regulation, you know, whether it's helping our children regulate, but as you say, first being regulated ourselves, how within reach it can be, regardless of our childhood, regardless of the circumstances of the moment, that it's as near as your breath, literally.
Exactly. Exactly.
Beautiful practice, and it sort of ties in with a question. We don't have a lot of time, but there, I don't know if you want to say more about that to wrap that up, or if I can ask you something related.
Well, I'll just get to the modifying part and the integration piece to close.
Okay.
But I'm happy to go wherever you want to go.
No, let's hear more because, I had sort of caught you in the middle of that midstream of the modifying, so please.
Yeah, just to finish that up. So, you know, if you do this breath practice, even for a couple minutes a day, you know, research shows that you will actually strengthen your ability to create more integrative growth in your brain to create more harmony in your life, basically. So doing this is the best gift you can give to your kids because you are role modeling for them how to develop a resilient and kind mind. And that's really what we want to do. It's not ultimately so much what we do as parents, it's who we are. And who we are can change by training your mind to integrate your brain. So the modifying piece here is if you build this breath this into your life. You literally start achieving more integration just by doing that. But if you want to take it the next step, just download the Wheel of Awareness practice from our website and try that out. The feedback we've been getting from parents who do this is just unbelievably rewarding, because it doesn't cost anything. It's just your own intention. You can modify the wheel practice based on the time that you have available. And literally what this does is allows you to modify energy and information flow toward integration. And integration is the linkage of differentiated parts. So if you were here in my office, I would show you this big table I have, which looks like a wheel. It's got a center glass thing and an outer wood part. And in this wheel metaphor, what we do is we say the hub of this wheel is the sense of knowing within awareness. The awareness has these two components, the known and the knowing. So the hub represents the knowing. The rim, the outer part of this wheel, represents that which can be known, like what you see or what you hear, what you taste, or the interior of the body, you know, what your intestines are sending you signals about, or your heart or your muscles, your bones. Then there's a third part of the rim is, you know, your thoughts and feelings, your memories, images, things like that. And there's even a fourth part of the rim, these four segments, which is the sense of your connectedness to other people and the planet. And, you know, when you do the wheel practice, what's so exciting about it is every time it's a little different, and you have the opportunity then literally to differentiate all the different components of consciousness. And then by sending a spoke of attention from the hub to the rim and systematically moving around the rim, you can actually link all of these differentiated parts of consciousness. So in a way, what you're doing is you're integrating consciousness, which I think is ultimately what all the different contemplative practices get you to do, is that they're having you build the capacity to monitor with more strength, so you see with more depth and detail, and what you see is in focus and clear. And then once you can monitor with more stability like that, then you're ready to modify. And in our view, the modification that creates health is shaping or transforming energy and information flow toward integration. So if you want to integrate consciousness, it's a great way as a parent to create this internal sense of clarity and harmony that emerges from integration. And then that presence that the wheel allows you to develop in the hub of the mind, if you will, allows you to go and create the kind of presence which effective parenting really requires. Parenting really is about this ability to sense what's going on in your child so that the child feels seen. You want to be able to soothe your child so that when your child's in distress, you can bring them to a place of feeling more in balance and with equilibrium. You want to keep them safe, so that means protecting them from harm, and also if you get agitated and look terrified or are terrifying in some way, you want to try to avoid that if you can, and since most of us do that at some point, you want to repair the ruptures that happen. And if you do that, if your child experiences being seen, because you're tuning into not just their behavior but their internal world, soothing them so you can comfort them, being safe in all these ways, repairing unsafety when it happens, they're going to develop security. Those are the four S's of attachment: seen, soothe, safe, and secure. So ultimately, that all requires presence. So if you're distracted all the time and you can't be available in these ways, it's going to be challenging for your child. And the good news is this is win-win-win, because if you develop presence, your child will thrive. If you develop presence, you'll not only, literally the studies show, be happier, but you also should be healthier. And what I mean by that is your immune system will function better. You'll have a brain that wants to approach rather than avoid challenges. And then, to boot, you'll have these enzymes in your body called telomerase, telomere ACE, the enzyme that repairs and maintains the caps on your chromosomes called telomeres, will actually be in a healthier, higher state because you have more presence. So the message I guess I want to make sure I state is that your work as a parent to create presence is good for your child. It's good for your relationships. It's good for your body. It's good for your mind. It's good all around. And so we now know from a scientific point of view that presence is our important starting place to develop the attunement, the resonance, the trust that is essential for how we bring the major part we can play with our kids. And I remember that with the word part, P-A-R-T, presence, attunement, resonance, and trust. That's really what parenting is about, and I think we can all help each other achieve that.
Mm. Wow. It's, you know, listening to you, and because I've had the benefit and the luxury of listening to each of the speakers, I'm seeing this whole summit take shape as a puzzle with each person contributing this perfect and vital piece. And I love the piece that you've just put in there because it's so clear, but there's so much science behind it. It's so substantiated. It isn't just a nice fluffy idea that you're promoting. You're not just saying it would be really good for your soul to be present, but you're supporting it with so much research and understanding that maybe helps encourage us to really take action as opposed to just listen and find it, you know, of interest.
Yeah, I mean, the exciting thing, of course, is that, you know, the science is confirming what wisdom practices may have been teaching us for thousands of years, which for me is just plain wonderful. But the science is exciting because it allows us to actually create some new things. And one of the things which is so exciting to me is that when you create integration within you and between you, the result of integration made visible, is kindness and compassion.
Mm, beautiful.
So that's the connection between living a wise and kind life and living a healthy and happy life, mm-hmm. is they all emerge from creating integration within us and between us. And that's something we can help each other do.
Yes. And you know, I'm smiling because those on the call who may have heard me before know that one of the features of my work is this idea of parents being what I call the captain of the ship in their child's life, that our life or our child's life is sort of a voyage and that somebody needs to be calmly and confidently in charge, and how deeply comforting it is to a child when they recognize that they have a reliable captain, a capable captain. Eventually, of course, we're transitioning to our kids being their own captain, but this the piece that you added, just to fold it in, or as I'm integrating it with my own understanding, has to do with really allowing people to be more captain-y, right? So when you anchor or tether yourself inside, even for a minute or two a day, and you find a place of quiet and stillness and regulation, to use your language, then you are better positioned to be a presence of kindness and compassion and support and connection with your child. So it just each piece rolls and folds into the other so elegantly. I'm just sort of awed and very humbled to see how we each are coming to this subject from our own particular, as you said, our own particular strength or passion, but how beautifully they integrate with each other. So thank you so much.
Oh, well, thank you, Susan. And thank everyone who want to take the time and be present to listen.
Yes. I want to remind everyone that we've been listening to Dr. Daniel Siegel. His site, again, is drdansiegel.com, drdansiegel.com. And again, if you have comments, please visit parentingwithpresence.com/comments. And I'm reading them. I'm interacting with people there. I really want to hear what's working for you, what you're inspired by, what you'd like to hear more of. So please take part in that conversation. There are replays that you can also listen to, including this call, for 48 hours, so you can visit the site for that. Coming up next is John Gray. John Gray, as you probably know, is the author of Men Are From Mars, Women Are From Venus, and he's going to be talking about positive reinforcement in parenting. Thank you all again for listening. Thank you, Daniel, for taking part in this summit.
My pleasure, Susan. Thank you.
And thank you all for joining. We look forward to staying connected. Bye-bye.